From KQED Public Radio and the California Report, this is the Capital Notes Podcast for Friday, June 17th. I'm John Myers from KQED, and it has been a busy, interesting, and unprecedented week here at the state capitol.
Clerk will open the roll. All members vote who desire to vote. All members vote who desire to vote.
That was the sound of the official vote beginning in the state assembly on the budget on Wednesday, June 15th. That budget bill passed both the Senate and the Assembly on a majority vote, the first time in 78 years that that has happened. And everyone thought, there you go. There's a budget. You may not love it, but it's done. But no, we were not done, as we all found out on Thursday morning in a quick one-minute YouTube address from Governor Jerry Brown.
Today, I have vetoed the California state budget. I do so reluctantly, but with clear purpose. For a decade, the can has been kicked down the road and debt has piled up. In January, I presented a balanced budget solution of deep spending cuts and a proposal to let the people of California vote on whether to extend some taxes on a temporary basis. Unfortunately, the Republicans said no. They didn't want the people of California to have that right to vote. The Democrats, on the other hand, made some very deep cuts. And in the budget that I received today, there was more positive work. Unfortunately, it doesn't go far enough. California is facing a fiscal crisis, and very strong medicine must be taken. So I am vetoing it today because I don't want to see more billions in borrowing, legal maneuvers that are questionable, and a budget that will not stand the test of time.
So let's figure out what happened with the exciting budget and veto and everything in between this week. Two very smart reporters sitting in here. No, not you guys. Sorry, the other two. No. Kevin Yamamura from the Sacramento Bee and Shane Goldmacher from the Los Angeles Times, both sitting in to rap about the budget. Actually, not a rap.
It takes two of us to equal one Anthony York.
So. No, actually, we brought in like the A-team this time. York is, what, he went to Blythe with the governor, is that right?
York is in Blythe today.
I'm telling you, you know, and I just decided that the phone connection in Blythe was just not worth it. So, plus, you know, he'd be cribbing off of you guys anyway. So we all sat through this saga that was this week. I figured I'd start ask each of you, kind of tell me, and we'll just go from there. What do you think the big takeaway from the week is in terms of like either where we stand, what to make of it? I mean, any way, shape, or form you would take it. We'll go in alphabetical order. So that's our last name because that'd be Goldmacher, Yamamura. So
I'm used to it.
That's all right. You get to be, you're batting cleanup.
Yeah.
I think that the takeaway is we're looking in mid-June to be exactly where we are at the end of March, which is Republicans, Democrats disagree. We're no closer to a budget. There was a budget. It got vetoed. And they're back to square one, pretty much.
So it's like a three-month standstill, then.
It's pretty much a three-month.
Or a 360 or whatever. We've come back to where we started.
We're 0 degrees. 0 degrees of separation total. We're back where we started, and the governor's not any closer to getting Republicans. They haven't even been talking to each other for, depending on who you ask, at least a full week, up to 2 weeks, sitting down with the full group of them. Fiscal year 2 weeks away. Looking likely like another year without a budget.
I was going to say, a year without a budget on July 1st isn't new, but the rest of it's been unusual. What's your takeaway?
Well, I was going to say that I didn't realize that Warren Furutani was the enforcer of the assembly was my takeaway.
The almost fight that happened on the assembly floor on Wednesday, yes.
No, I agree with Shane. I mean, I think the speaker said they were back at square one, and that's where it seems like they are. I remember in March thinking, the governor thinks he can somehow work out this deal to get the tax election, even though June no longer became an option after talks broke down in March. But, you know, he has to have a game plan here. And if he has one, he's not showing it to us
or to
Democratic his fellow
leaders.
Democrats.
Yeah.
But he clearly thinks he has some strategy to get this done.
Well, the Wednesday budget, I was going to roll back into it for a moment. I mean, the budget that was voted on Wednesday, and, you know, it's such an unusual week to have these historic markers, and yet we are back exactly where we feel like we are every summer. You know, we had the first majority vote budget since 1933 in the state, which is kind of when we started with this supermajority threshold. We have the first budget veto. We've all gone trying to figure out what the hell the exact date is. We never could come up with an exact date, but there are no records.
1901.
Yeah, there are no records that show it ever happening before, right? The budget, we didn't have budget bills until, what, 1922. Dotson Wilson, the smartest man in the Capitol, the chief clerk of the assembly, says they don't even have anything to 1901. I don't know. Somebody in 1848 could have gotten ticked off and vetoed something. But
they probably handled that with a duel.
That was Jerry Brown's first term.
I was going to say, a duel similar to what we had on the assembly floor. Yes. Jerry Brown's first term. We couldn't get both jokes in. And yet here we are, like I said, back to a familiar thing. But if you look at that Wednesday budget, that June 15th budget, it was roughly, what, a $10 billion fix. I wrote down some of the highlights just because it was painful to do so. I think, I mean, and obviously there were some real cuts. They were small, fair to say, but UC, CSU, courts would have gotten cut more. That turned out to not be very popular. You know, it's like it's hard to categorize. I don't know what you guys would like what was
I
real.
Mean, if you break it
what's
down,
real and what's not. Yeah.
They had a $10 billion of solution. And if you sort of add it up, it was $950 million of more cuts.
Right.
And, you know, $1.5 billion of taxes, which puts your other solutions at, you know, $7, $8 billion.
Taxes and or fees.
Taxes and or fees, yeah. Car fees, taxes. That's $8 billion of other. That's an awful lot of other.
And I think it was kind of described early on as you know, there was even an admission that about half of it was risky and half of it was not risky. And maybe it was more than that. But whatever the risky factor was, it was clearly too much for the governor. And you know, it's interesting. I don't know what you guys, your feeling was. But, you know, the budget passed on Wednesday and we all sat there and watched it pass. And I think we all kind of wrote these stories about, oh, what this difficult position it put the governor in. Well, it didn't seem like it was a very difficult position for him. I mean, with lightning speed, I actually think that YouTube video, I don't know when it was shot, but I had the feeling like it was shot the afternoon the budget passed. I mean, it was daylight behind him. I mean, this wasn't something he agonized over. This was quick.
No, and certainly...
In other words, we were wrong that it was agonizing for him, right?
Yeah, although... Let's see. I mean, there may be more agony for him later if, you know, he doesn't get a deal in the next 2 weeks. We'll see what happens if, you know, July 1st comes along and at that point the tax extensions aren't a possibility.
And that I think is a huge that to me is a really big point to as I end the week that I think about is that July 1st becomes then impossible to carry out the strategy the way he's had. I mean, some people would argue it's already gone. Because this bridge tax of making Republicans go up on a tax vote conditional to a later approval by the voters. But the reality is it's gone on July 1st. They are then completely tax increases.
And I think you just have to look at the latest polling in that field poll to say the bridge tax is not a fiscal issue alone. It's a political issue that support for taxes. If you call it a tax increase, it drops pretty dramatically compared to calling it a tax extension.
And it ain't good when you start over the tax extension.
It's not looking good in the first place, and you make the other one, it looks downright impossible. And so, you know, July 1, if there's not an agreement, I think we see a whole new set of negotiations start or end entirely.
And probably negotiation, I mean, at that point, you really do have to wonder, does he even talk to Republicans at that point? Probably the negotiations become... the governor, the pro tem, and the speaker.
And I mean, clearly, we all got that sense. I was sitting in the room, but talking to people afterwards, lovely point where I had a sick kid, and I thought, LA's got the whole story. And then all of a sudden, things start happening, and I drop the sick kid off and come back to work. But if you listen to what the pro tem and the speaker, Perez and Steinberg, said on Thursday, and then just talking to people, too, you get the sense that the biggest grumbling point here is that they don't feel like the governor has ever given them any sense of what my backup plan is. Not so much that he vetoed it. I don't think that was a terrible surprise. Doesn't sound like they got a lot of advance notice that the governor was going to veto it. But that they want to know where he's going. And I think Steinberg said that clearly, too. I mean, you know, we don't know what else are you going to do if this doesn't work?
Well, I mean, the Democrats made it a big point to say, you know, we're passing this budget on June 15th. It's not about keeping our paychecks. We have to meet our constitutional responsibility. And then the governor the next day vetoes it. And it starts to make it look like more and more it was done about their paychecks, because if it's not having any chance of going into law, the governor didn't even take 24 hours to consider it. It puts them in a bad spot. It makes them look like they pushed this through for that reason to some point.
I think that's true. And I also think, the speed with which this veto came did catch them off guard. I do believe that. I mean, they probably knew that a veto was coming, but perhaps they wanted the governor to let that hang out, the bill hang out there for a little while, and just to see if that changed any of the dynamic in negotiations. The governor comes out with a veto, and He obviously had a different strategy, and it seemed like from what they were saying yesterday, the Democrats aren't being kept abreast of what that strategy is. They don't know. I mean, they feel the governor has no plan B, and they think it's time to start thinking about plan B. And what we seem to be hearing from the governor is that it's not yet time to think about plan B until July 1st, perhaps.
Right. July 1st comes around, and then he's forced to come up with a plan B. And that seems right. It was kind of fun to watch for all the back and forth of how politics changes things. There was a very nice, like, I don't know, civics class separations of power moment in all of this. The legislature told the governor, I mean, through the Democratic leadership, as we all know, before they rolled out their majority vote budget, time's up. We're done. We're doing this. And we've all heard that. There were discussions there in the governor's office. They told him what was coming down the pike. And we all knew it, kind of. And you tried to, Kevin, you tried to kind of pull it out of the governor on Monday about what would he do if he got that. And he almost gave you the answer that was almost true. But anyway, so here it was. The legislature used their constitutional authority to send a budget to the governor. They're not required to have big fives or consult with them or do whatever else. The governor used his constitutional authority to veto the thing and send it back to him. And so, I mean, from that perspective, for me, it was a very nice, clean moment. There wasn't a lot of other stuff in between. Like, you remember in Schwarzenegger era in 2008, he threatened to veto it. Mm-hmm. And the last moment, they pulled it back and they came up with this and they retweaked that and that. And it all ultimately worked out, maybe. But this was very easy to follow if you're the public. Passed it, vetoed it. Now what? So, I don't know.
In our constitutional lessons, the perhaps the only winner of the week is the California Supreme Court Chief Justice, who said the entire budget was going to be devastating to her branch of government. It got vetoed, and she said she was, that's thrilling, that they were going to have to close courts, and suddenly, she lives to fight another day.
UC, CSU, both were going to lose money, and they were talking about it.
I also think, in the short term, at least, the governor comes out a winner. I mean, think about all the praise he's been getting from people in the last 2 days over his veto. He comes out looking like he's a hero for standing up to the legislature on a gimmicky budget. Again, we'll see if he faces agony at some point, a couple weeks from now. But I mean,
well, and I want to let's talk about that for a moment, because that's a really fascinating point for me, because it was pointed out to me by a person smarter than me last night. We were sitting talking about this, and that it's very difficult to get a full sense of what the governor's action looked like sitting here in Sacramento. That there is an insular nature to Sacramento so much that how would it play everywhere else? And that what looks like pragmatism in Sacramento, which I think is truly what the Democratic leaders thought they were doing. I don't want to ascribe either completely noble motives or evil motives to anyone. So I'm, people will read into
motive.
This that think I'm like, I love them or I hate this person, but whatever. But they were being pragmatic, I think, with trying to figure out that they did whatever they could do to do what they could do. But what looks like pragmatism in Sacramento doesn't necessarily look like that as this was being laid out to me. It's a good point. Elsewhere in the state, that looks like a kind of conniving X, Y, and Z. And the governor has this very clear, as we said, thing that he says, I promised people I wasn't going to sign it, and I was serious. I wasn't going to sign anything with gimmicks or things that weren't really solutions.
It looks like he took the high road to people. I mean, it looks like he's fulfilling his pledge not to do the gimmicks, not to do the budgets of the past. I think to the three of us, perhaps having seen this budget process transpire in the previous years, we kind of, say that's a nice thought, but there is a sort of pragmatic side to this that you wonder, how long can he stick with this? And I think the next 2 weeks will be a test. And we feel like we're at square one. And
with more antimosity and anger than we had in March. Now the Democrats don't like the governor.
Yeah, it's not a Democratic
and the Republicans don't like the governor.
Exactly. It's a three-way fight in a way, in some ways.
And does that moral high ground lead the state off a cliff? I mean, he was talking a few months ago to George Skelton, and he talked about a war of all against all, and he's sort of started to repeat that. And what he's talking about is not signing any kind of budget. The Democrats won't do the cuts he's demanding. He won't sign the kind of budget they already passed that he vetoed. And the result is no budget. And, the state really getting into a mess and having to have a big election to solve it.
Yeah, it's a good thing. I mean, Shane pointed it out before we started. George Skelton, the columnist at the LA Times, sat down with the governor, when was it? Several months ago?
I think early March.
Yeah. And the guys at CalBuzz, Trounstein and Roberts, picked it up in their posting this morning, too, that if you look at that interview, right, that the governor was dead on exactly how this was going to play out. You know, I'm going to ask for X, they're going to do Y, I'm going to veto it, and here we are going to go.
Of and course, we're halfway through that path right now.
The problem is that he didn't lay out what happens beyond that, and probably because he couldn't completely see all of that. It seems like the other part of this, too, is that, you know, let's look at it from the Republican standpoint for a minute. Depending on who you believe, and I have to say that not only to be fair, but also because it's true, because I'm not really sure where the truth is here. Depending on who you believe, Republicans either never came to what their bottom line was on all of these side issues, or Democrats would never bend on their side to give them anything. And that, again, depends on who you believe about issues of pensions and spending cap and whatever. But setting that fight aside for a moment, there would seem to be a risk for Republicans to go too far in this. Because, Kevin, you alluded to something a moment ago that I was thinking about this morning, which is that this fight between Jerry Brown and the Democrats is going to end. I mean, I believe it's going to end. I don't think this is a severing of their relationship. It's a tiff. They'll get over it and they'll figure out what to do. When that fight ends, if the taxes, you know, if nothing happens by July 1st and the governor starts to have to make the case around the state, look, I did everything I could to do it X way, I've got to do Y. And you go around the Republicans, they have lost their opportunity to influence the process, and they tee themselves up for a 2012 election year where who knows what's going to happen. And so it seems like if you're a Republican in the legislature right now who's considering something, you're one of the negotiators or somebody else, you got a narrow window of time here that on your end too. I mean, fair to say.
And the governor's made clear that the Republican demands spending cap, pension changes, regulatory reform, that he wants to do those things, and he might push the Democrats to do it without the Republicans. And so there's a possibility that he moves forward on those issues without the Republicans, not in a form that they like perhaps, and sort of he claims all the high ground, or is going to try to at least, that he wants to say he's going to fix the budget in every regard, and sure, they won't go up on the taxes I need them to go up for, but I'm going to push through their ideas anyway.
I think that is what the governor is hoping for. I mean, I'm sorry, not the scenario that Shane laid out necessarily, but what you had said, John, about the Republicans perhaps coming to some realization that, look, the governor and the Democrats could pursue this without us. Maybe this is the chance the governor is seeing that perhaps they do come to some kind of a deal, recognizing that as of July 1st, the Democrats don't need them.
That the calculus at least changes, because yes, if the governor loses the centerpiece of his budget plan, which is the taxes, and who knows? I mean, the governor then could continue to argue for them as increases. I don't know. Who knows what? But if he loses that centerpiece, then who knows? I mean, all bets are off then, because now what do you do? But,
I mean, there's a real question whether the Democrats and labor unions who would be expected to fund that election are even willing to vote for an election this fall with the extensions or without the extensions at this point. I mean, labor has come out and said, we don't want an election this year. We think we're going to lose. A lot of the Democrats privately are saying, we don't want an election. We think we're going to lose. And so that puts the governor in a hard spot. I mean, let's say the Republicans do say that they'd sign off on that bridge tax, which they've said they wouldn't, or even if they were willing to vote for it without a bridge tax, would the Democrats? And if you've only got two Republicans in each House who are going to vote for it, you need to bring every Democrat along, which means only a couple of them need to be pulled off by labor unions to prevent that from ever going to the ballot. I mean, he's going to face, you know, pushing and pulling on both sides of the political spectrum.
I think that the bridge is, I mean, that's a minimum cost for the Democrats to sign on. No bridge. Democrats aren't going for that deal. As you said, I mean, unions are
you
already—
You mean it's a bridge to nowhere? Sorry.
Well,
someone already used that, not only famously nationally, but even this week. I was like, okay, I was waiting for someone to recreate that or resurrect that motto. But go ahead.
Well, no bridge. Democrats don't go for that. As you said, Shane, I mean, unions aren't all that enthusiastic, and Democrats privately aren't all that enthusiastic about a special election in the fall and taxes. The polls, as we mentioned earlier, don't seem very favorable for that election. If they lose again like they did in 2009, I mean, this really puts Democrats in a tough position arguing for taxes in the Capitol thereafter. I don't know. I mean, it seems like that point, it would be hard to get a tax through the Capitol.
And there are a lot of Democrats, I mean, both in the Capitol and then political people, interest groups, whoever, who really think that they're on the verge of something big next year in the election. Combination of new political maps, top two primary, demographic issues, voter registration, president on the ballot in November 2012. Yeah. They sense that they're on the verge of getting a lot of stuff, that they don't have to give up things to Republicans.
Exactly.
Now, that does miss one of the most important political undercurrents, which is anger about pensions. And that could be the war of all against all that the governor talked about in some ways. But that certainly got to influence the desire about whether you strike a deal or not. And you know, for now, the governor has either acted as though he's immune from that, or he has just turned a deaf ear to it in some ways. But as time goes on and all kinds of pressures start to, you know, be out there, who knows?
Well, we heard the speaker say that this is a multi-year workout plan that is built into this plan the legislature put forth, is assuming a November 2012 tax initiative. That's an electorate that they like.
I mean, initiative, ballot measure, something. Yeah.
Democrat, yeah, or ballot measure, but, you know, if they can't get the support in the legislature, then
I mean, 18 months from now. I mean, 18 months is a budget and a half. That's two budgets away. I mean, for them to be hoping for voters to approve taxes 18 months from now seems like that's an awfully hard way to balance your budget now.
It is, but they think they I mean,
it's their best
shot. Express confidence
in these
gimmicks or maneuvers that they have and that they've relied on in the past
to
kind of just keep papering it over. I mean, what's another 18 months after so many years of doing it, I suppose, is...
We all struggled for the right description. Clever, you know, creative.
Nifty.
Nifty.
I don't know if any of us use nifty in our story. I don't even think I've...
I may have tried that. It may not have lasted.
Editor took that out of your story. I just wanted one other quick thing on the Republican thing. I want to switch to the paychecks and all this kind of fun intrigue. But I got a sense, one, that was just kind of just feeling like there was body language, and two, and one that was very overt, about that Republicans sensed they were on the cusp of changes and that their window could be limited here to get something during the budget debate. One was it just felt like there was a flatness to the Republicans, that they knew this was a fait accompli. This budget was going off the floor. And so all of the floor speeches felt flatter to me because they knew. And that's not to say they don't know it some other times, but they had no input on this document. I mean, they were not caught flat-footed completely by it being brought up. But I mean, they were still tweeting and talking about taxes all the way up until the point where the hammer dropped and they said, "Guess what? We're voting on a budget tomorrow."
And they didn't even launch their usual complaints about not being in print for 24 hours, yeah, and we didn't have time to read it, and this is still warm. And the truth is that they didn't need to read it. They knew they weren't voting for it, and their votes weren't going to matter.
And their votes didn't matter. They were completely sidelined. And so that was kind of a body language issue. But the overt one was Bob Dutton, the Republican leader in the state Senate. Listen to the floor speech he gave. I mean, I should have played it in the thing. But listen to it. Actually, I don't want to play it because like I kept listening and going, there's no sound bites here. But therein lies the thing. He specifically pulled back the red meat criticism of Democrats. He did it again on our air on the forum program on KQED on Thursday morning before the veto. And I just wonder if that's not some sense that Dutton realizes he's got to go back to the table somehow, or that there was no reason in flaming. I mean, I don't know. I haven't talked to them. I don't know.
But it was
noticeable to me that it was not the general tenor of Republicans talking about Democrats. It was a very muted speech about nothing. But I don't know. Did you notice that at all?
Well, I spoke with him the day of the vote, and he said the fact that the Democrats were pushing this through proved the Republicans' point that the whole bridge tax wasn't a real policy issue, that they don't need that money, and that this makes it even less likely that they're going to negotiate. Now, Bob Dutton hasn't been the one negotiating. He hasn't been at the negotiating table
really
at all.
And has complained about that several times.
And he has. And when he was in the negotiating table with the governor and the governor's wife, he didn't like the way he was treated.
She yelled at me,
she yelled at him, I believe, was the
quote or something.
I believe that was the quote. You know, but he's saying this is just another reason to not even go back to the negotiating table. So I agree with that body language. That was clearly the body language of the building. But they still don't see it as a reason to go back to the table necessarily.
Yeah, in which case the governor's not really getting anywhere fast on that. So let's talk about the fun intrigue of the paychecks. And something tells me we're all going to have to sit and watch this next week. So we all know, and people who would listen to a podcast like this apparently would probably know, but why not? I'll say it again. That in Prop 25, and I love people who say that Prop 25 was passed all because the voters wanted to give a majority vote budget. No, every television commercial, everything about it was they don't get paid if they don't pass a budget.
So it's like here people who say that Prop 1A failed because of the spending cap.
Sure, but who knows why it failed.
Yes.
Yes, but yeah. So this was, yeah, so every breath of the campaign was about the paychecks. And so here we are, the budget passed on the 15th. If you read, and this is the hard part, because I'm going to probably get, somebody's going to call and yell at me here. But I think if you read the common language understanding of Prop 25, it says pass a budget. It doesn't say a governor has to sign it, doesn't say anything.
It says send it to the governor.
It just says send it to the governor. Right, exactly. If they'd held it as they did in March, that wouldn't qualify. But so they sent it to the governor. And now the question is, should they get paid? Because the governor didn't completely explicitly call it an unbalanced budget in his veto message, but said everything but that it wasn't really fairly balanced. I don't remember what the phrase was.
Not,
it was very careful.
Not a balanced budget.
Or not a balanced approach or something. There was some nuance there.
But he also said it was not financeable, which I think is interesting. I mean,
which goes to the issue of having to borrow money for short-term operating cash. And so now
interesting, I think, I mean, it's interesting that Chung inserted himself earlier this month in the way he did. I remember
That's what we're going to get to, because you're shorthand. The controller, John Chung, now has got an issue in front of him about how Prop 25 works. And as you're saying, Kevin, he already did this.
But going back, I mean, I remember covering the campaign and even analyzing these ads and thinking at that time and talking with even people on both sides of the campaign, whether it was privately or publicly, that, yeah, the pay provision was fairly weak. I mean, that, you know, the legislature could pass one of these drill-type budgets and still get paid. And there was, you know, even open a question, you know, up to, I think, even May, there was even an open question as to whether they had to directly send it. I mean, Ledge Council apparently told the Senate, according to the Secretary of the Senate, that, you know, that the legislature may have already done its job under Prop 25 by passing the budget.
And so here we are with a Democratic controller probably taking a line that some Democrats do not like. And so now he is in the middle of this discussion. It's about the interaction between Prop 25 and Prop 58. Balanced budget. Is it balanced? Did it have to be balanced to meet the paycheck trigger?
Well, I think the fascinating thing is that Controller Chung has inserted himself as the arbiter of who gets paid and who doesn't get paid. I mean, the ballot measure doesn't say anything about, and the controller shall decide what qualifies as a legitimate budget. And so suddenly you've got whomever's elected controller every 4 years gets to independently decide whether lawmakers get paid.
Well,
that's a fascinating question.
And to a bigger point, what I think is the precedent that it could set, I would argue, about the controller being the arbiter of what is a balanced budget.
Absolutely.
And what revenues are real. And it's interesting that this is coming up because one of the things, you know, people talk about reforms of the broken process of state government in California. And I don't know that it would fix it, but I was intrigued by one of these reporter conferences. It was a State House Reporters Conference I went to last year, listening to how other states do their budget process. And there are other states where the controller, or it's called the comptroller in other states, does an independent certification of revenues or an independent certification of something. And at the time, it stuck in my head like, wow, if we had really separated out the certification of some part of the budget process outside of the legislature or outside of the governor's own budget team, what would that look like? And what might that, you know, be a check, double check, whatever in the process? So, you know, so now I get to where we've got a controller who either explicitly or implicitly is kind of putting himself in a position or his successor to do that in years from now.
7 years ago, Californians passed Proposition 58, which says you have to have a balanced budget. And the question is, well, what's a balanced budget and who's to enforce that? And there's been nobody. A balanced budget has been the legislature passes it and the governor signs it.
And it was intentionally done that way. It was
absolutely
a watered-down thing from Schwarzenegger and Democrats.
And
right?
now Chung is saying for the first time, well, with this pay provision, I actually get to say whether it's balanced or not. And that's really a new authority that he's seized for himself. And no one's really questioned that that's his authority. In fact, Governor Brown yesterday said it is Controller Chung's decision.
This is going to be a real test of whether he actually uses that authority that he's apparently created for himself. I mean, if he pays these guys, I don't know. I mean, how strong is that authority? Because he will have. I mean, there two other fiscal officials have essentially said this budget doesn't pencil out. It's not
state
financeable.
Treasurer. The state treasurer said, basically said the same thing.
And John Chung is in charge of cash flow. I mean,
he writes the checks.
He's the guy who manages cash, makes sure we have enough cash on hand to pay bills. I mean, if he pays the legislators, you know, it's an interesting position he's in, I think, that, you know, he's decided that he has to pay them under Prop 25, even though other fiscal leaders have decided that this isn't really a balanced budget.
It's somewhat of the times in which John Chung, a Democrat from L.A., has served as controller. But he has been, I would argue, the most high-profile controller in a very long time. I mean, Gray Davis tried to make the job high-profile and then, of course, catapulted himself ultimately to being governor. Other people have come through. Steve Wesley had gubernatorial aspirations as controller, but it's somewhat of the time.
It helps if you're managing cash in a cash crisis. You
exactly.
get to get yourself in the news
That's
a little
exactly
bit.
That's exactly where I was going to go. I mean, it has been somewhat of the sign of the times that Chung has been in the headlines a lot. But, you know, he had a fight with Schwarzenegger over pay in the absence of a budget. He was the guy who was
always in the
minimum wage. He was in the fight about IOUs and was front and center when the state had to issue them in 2009. Here he is back again, and so now here we are back again in this, and everybody watching him. And Kevin, you wrote about this afternoon. He's already getting pressure from the right to stop the pay or else. I mean, you can talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association sent him a letter today saying that he should not pay legislators, and that if he does pay them, they're going to sue. Of course, if he doesn't pay legislators, I wouldn't be surprised at all if
they sue.
So, I mean, that would certainly would be an interesting situation if a legislator did sue the controller over this particular budget. I can't imagine that would look great for that legislator.
Well, not to mention –
we're guessing that would be a termed out legislator. I'm going to make a safe bet that
if somebody sues, it's going to be somebody leaving office. I'm coming up with a name.
I think Gil Cedillo would be my Gil Cedillo first.
He has practice.
He's already sued over pay.
Democrat of L.A. who sued over the pay commission's pay rate that they set for lawmakers. And I think the other part that would be fascinating too, if legislators, and again, folks will know by I don't know what day, Monday, Tuesday, whatever the controller decides to tell us. But let's say that the controller cut off the pay just for fun. And so you have these legislators, whoever they will be, step forward. Do they have to make some case about how they don't have any money and how their personal finances are bad, in which case then doesn't become the question, if you can't manage your own finances, how do you manage?
We've already had Cameron Smythe, the Republican Assemblyman from Santa Clarita, say first paycheck he misses, his mortgage is going on a credit card. That's a worrisome financial management practice.
You, Mr. Yamamura, I'm pointing at you because you had a good tweet about this, didn't you?
I did. It was not a personal slight at Mr. Smythe, but I do, you know, I mean, I
duly noted.
Do think that, you know, people making $95,000, I realize there are differences in family size. I realize there are differences in where people live, but I don't know. I think if you make $95,000, you should be able to set a little bit aside for your own personal rainy day fund. And I know that's the first thing that
maybe it's just
that young people are taught these days.
Personal spending cap. That's
maybe
the solution.
Just,
and so somebody did tweet back at me, well, is this an indicative of our larger problem that people are living paycheck to paycheck who are representing us in the legislature?
But maybe it's just us people in the news business who always feel as though our news organizations are going to go under and lay us off, who have thought about this,
yes.
What if I don't have money thing. So who knows?
And the Los Angeles Times has been in bankruptcy for a couple of years. We're doing all right.
Oh, well, there you go. Then they will come see you, Shane, when they need a loan to float if they don't get their paychecks. Well, that'll be fun to watch. But bottom line, it was an interesting week. I mean, for all the weeks that we say that things really don't happen or negotiations are slow, it was a hell of an interesting week. A lot of different things happened that were
highly unusual. And I mean, the different things that happened.
A daylight budget debate. Yeah. Who would have thunk?
Right. Walked out of the Capitol, and it was still the same day that you walked in.
Yeah. We got a fight, a budget before dinner time, and a veto the next morning.
We didn't talk about the fight. We've gone too long. We didn't even talk about the dust-up between Warren Furutani, Democrat.
The assembly face-off, as you
L.A., as I hashtagged.
Labeled.
And Don Wagner from Irvine, Republican. It's probably not even worth going back into, but a Sopranos reference that turned into a supposed slight against Italian Americans, and Mr. Furutani, who is not an Italian American.
No, but he got up and was concerned. Mr. Wagner's face, and the next thing we knew, they were jawing at each other and had to be broken up by colleagues right in front of you.
And there were two photos, one bad one I took with my iPhone and one that was great from Hector.
John got the first one up.
And see, never a
dull moment. I got one from the back of the chamber, which, you know, you can't make out anything. So.
See, you print guys, you're sitting in the back. You missed out. I was right near the action. Now, if it had been happening with, well, come up with all the members in the back of the assembly, that would be another story. But, yeah, you know.
It was amazing to see all these aides and staffers come into the back of the chamber immediately after they either saw it on Cal Channel or saw it on Twitter or whatever. But
the great thing
everybody
about
was like, it just reminded me of the days back in elementary school where two kids would get in a fight and then everybody's like, fight. And then everybody rushes over and crowds them. But
now with the speed of
time. And I was never the one in the fights. I was always the guy yelling fight, which I guess is still my role now.
You've grown up, but you kept the same role, which is to observe and to tell everyone that there was a fight. Because I think, right, literally, we were both on Twitter going, whoa, fight. You couldn't type fast enough. You couldn't type for Furutani. You know, bless his heart, but I can't type for Furutani. I couldn't remember
how to spell it. I was still in the middle of typing the comment that Don Wagner had made, the second comment that offended people. And the next thing I knew, I look up and these guys are going at it.
It was good times.
Yeah.
So if we could just see that again, you know, any more fun to keep us awake?
I think the Cal Channel really didn't focus nearly enough on the events. They went right back to the days and no video.
I wanted a new camera angle too. I didn't want that back camera angle. What are they doing? Are they just trying to provide a civic service here, or they want to show me the fight? Oh well. Anyway, I'll call the Cal Channel, see how that goes. Kevin Yamamura, Sacramento Bee, Shane Goldmacher from the LA Times, thank you guys for sitting in. And
thank you.
We'll banish Anthony York to Blythe more often.
Absolutely.
That should be a good spot for you. You should say that, sitting in the bureau with him. I'm John Myers from KQED. We'll see you next time.